From Beyond Marketing, it's the 20-Minute Call, a podcast about the dreamers, boundary pushers, rebels, and champions of the skydiving industry. Each episode is a narrative journey highlighted by the highs, lows, and luck that the skydiving industry delivers, as told by the most influential people within the sport. If you've ever dreamed of becoming a skydiver, perhaps opening a drop zone, or becoming the next world champion, check out the 20-Minute Call hosted by me, James LeBarry. My guest today spent 27 years in the U.S. Army and was a former member of the prestigious U.S. Army parachute team, the Golden Knights. During his competition career, which continues today, he's achieved the highest accolades in formation skydiving. His titles include being a 7-time world champion in 8-way, a 3-time World Cup champion in 8-way, a 1 World Cup championship in 4-way, a 12-time national champion in 8, 10, and 16-way, and a 6-time silver medalist in 4-way at the U.S. Nationals. Since retiring from the Golden Knights, he was invited to compete with another legendary team, Arizona Airspeed, as well as Paraclete XP8. Aside from being one of the best skydivers in the world of formation skydiving, he is also a proud father, the podcast host to A Champion's Journey, a writer, artist, and professional DJ. Along with all of these titles, he's also one of the fittest people you will ever meet. Welcome to the 20-Minute Call podcast, Matt Davidson.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me, James.
Matt, it's a pleasure to have you. You've been in my sphere, if you will, for a very long time. And I had the pleasure of really sitting down with you for an interview. And that's the real joy of doing this and some of my other work is, rather than just sort of passing by in a hangar with quick acknowledgement, usually at a nationals or something, I get to indulge and ask you some great questions. So I'm grateful.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and thank you for having me on.
Well, let's dive right in. Matt, you recently retired from the U.S. Army after 27 years of service. Now, your grandfather was a Marine, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Your father was in the Special Forces, and it seems you've only known a life in the military. How are you adjusting to life as a civilian?
It's been a bit of an adjustment. The things that I miss the most about it are the camaraderie with teammates, but fortunately, it's been pretty smooth in respects of still being able to maintain those relationships. My wife is still in the military. She's currently down at Fort Novosel, Alabama, attending flight school. She's learning to fly Blackhawks right now. So I still feel like I have some connections there. And fortunately, very fortunately for me, I'm able to be a part of GKXP8. And on that team, we've got members of the current Golden Knights lineup. So it's those are guys that I've served with in the past and, you know, work closely together with guys like Jesse Stoller. He was a very close teammate and friend of mine. And I'm able to, you know, still maintain those relationships, still have some of the same conversations in the team room that we had when we were on the Golden Knights and, you know, joking around throughout the day. And it's allowed me to still maintain those contacts with the military. Occasionally, I'm able to do some military contract coaching work, and you know, so that still helps me to feel somewhat relevant and connected. So it's, I feel very fortunate in that respect.
I have to imagine it's got to be kind of strange, right? I'm speaking to you only as a civilian. And when I look at, like, there is I don't want to say a wall, but there is so much empathy I don't have for life in the military because I've never spent a day in the military. I think for some people, they'll have sort of a quote unquote civilian life and then they join the military, but you are sort of raised into military life with your entire family. I just can't imagine, I'm trying to have empathy for you where you sort of only know that world. It wasn't that you didn't know it before and then came into it. It's like it's all you've ever known. And then now there's this sort of disconnect from it. I imagine that's so strange.
It is strange. But again, you know, having those connections, it still makes me feel like I'm part of the military machine somehow, and it is a it's become a fabric of my being, it feels like. So it's it means a lot to me to still maintain those connections. I really believe in what the military does in defense of our nation, and in helping to build the citizens up of our country, not only through defense but also through the opportunities the military offers. You know, I was able to reap the benefits of those opportunities, and still am, because of my 27 years of service. But I think it just taught me so much on how to be, you know, a better person. I was surrounded by great people, great leadership throughout my entire career, and was just extremely fortunate to have that experience. And, you know, I really encourage other young people out there who might be thinking about that as a possibility in their lives to explore that possibility, because there are a lot of tremendous opportunities within, you know, that military structure.
What was your childhood like, being the son of a special forces soldier and who also served as the executive officer for the Golden Knights? And do you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother who was also in the Navy for 10 years. It was great. I think there were some pluses and minuses to the lifestyle. When I was a kid, my father was gone quite a bit, and that was, you know, tough on me. I remember when he left for deployment during the original waves of Desert Storm. He went over to Kuwait, and that was pretty rough on me. And younger, when he went to Ranger School and different places like that. That was actually one of the reasons why I started to skydive, and we can get into that later if you'd like. But, you know, I just wanted to spend more time with him. The benefits to it were, I think, is that because my father was steeped in that lifestyle, he was able to take some of what he learned and try to instill some discipline in me as a child, and you know, certain work ethics, and didn't always take hold right away, but eventually I think I was able to absorb some of those lessons that he taught me.
Did you need discipline as a child? What kind of kid were you?
My parents said that I was, you know, really good for the most part, but I definitely had my moments. You know, I think in high school, you know, there were a couple times where I stayed out drinking with friends, and, you know, would come home late, and they'd, you know, there was a story where they dropped me off on the front lawn and encouraged me to go up to the house, but I think they didn't want to get in trouble either. So, you know, it was probably 12 o'clock at night or something. And, you know, so my father came out, and it was after I was a skydiver too. I started skydiving when I was 16. He came out and walked up to me, and I remember his feet right in front of my face. And he said, "Get up now." And I was like, I really don't feel like it, but judging by the tone of his voice, I should probably get up right now. So, you know, I kind of stumbled up, and he was like, "Are you drunk?" And I laughed because I thought it was painfully obvious that I was. But later on, he said he thought maybe I'd been beat up and dropped off on the lawn or something. But, you know, so I laughed, said, "Yes, get in the house." So go get in the house. And the next morning I was supposed to go out jumping, and he had left. You know, I woke up and, you know, all bleary eyed, and he'd left. And I asked my mom, I was like, "Where's dad?" And I went looking for my parachute. I was like, "Where's my rig?" She was like, he took it out there with him. She's like, "You're not jumping today." So other than that, I think there are, you know, a couple times like that, but no big issues, I don't think.
I think this segues perfectly. Before graduating high school, you did make your first jump at 16. What about jumping was attractive to you that inspired you to make that jump?
I think there are several things. Being a 16-year-old boy, you know, I think I was like, "Oh, this is a cool activity. Might attract some girls." And I also thought that skydiving itself, you know, just looked like this incredibly cool activity. My father was, he started jumping in the late 70s and then stopped after just a few jumps. Then he started jumping again when he went down to, we were living in North Carolina at the time, and he moved down to Fort Benning while he was attending the master's program, I believe, down at Columbus College. And then he went on the weekends, he would go down and skydive with the Fort Rucker, now Fort Novosel, Sport Parachute Club. And he would, I remember when he came back to North Carolina, he would bring back videos of the skydives that he made and other skydiving videos on VHS. I remember just watching those videos over and over and just thinking it was the coolest thing. And in addition to that, I wanted to spend more time and bond more with my father, because up until that point, I'd been largely involved in theater with my mom. My mom was a very good influence as far as that goes. She was with a Boston Ballet Company when she was younger, and you know, so she was very involved with the dance theater of Fayetteville, North Carolina at the time, and some other dance studios around. So she had me involved in the Nutcracker performance and, you know, doing some other theater like that. I was very fortunate. She was great with encouraging me to be part of local community theater. So with the Cape Fear Regional Theater and with the Fort Bragg Playhouse at the time, I was able to do some great productions like The King and I. I was able to work with the understudy for Yul Brynner, who did the King and I Broadway production. So the understudy was the, you know, played the king, and I was able to land the part of Prince Chul Longhorn, and that was just an incredible experience. There was a huge cast of kids, and it was just this wonderful experience. And there are several other big productions like that I was able to be a part of. But I think I really missed that connection with my father because he was gone a lot. Once I told him when I was 14 that I wanted to skydive, I think there was a little bit of disbelief there just because, you know, I was a theater kid. And he was like, well, all right, I'll tell you what, at the time it was 16 years old with a waiver from your parents to be able to jump. Now it's 18, but at the time it was 16. And he was like, you still want to do it when you're 16? Let me know. So in the meantime, between 14 and 16, he would jump with the parachute clubs here in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So I would go up on the weekends and watch him jump. And I was exposed to all of the people around him, some great people, world champions like the Golden Knights and other great leaders in different units in the Army at Fort Bragg, special operations units and such. So I was exposed to a lot of great people at that time. And at 16 came around and I told him I wanted to skydive still. So for my 16th birthday, he took me down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, at the parachute club there at the time. And I learned to skydive, made my first jump out of a UH-1 UE helicopter. And that was a great experience.
If you're a DZO or DZM listening to this podcast and you're not using Burble, I've got a question. Why not? If the reason is price, what's the cost of your time? Other booking and manifest softwares are a one-size-fits-all. Burble was built from the ground up by a DZO for DZOs to maximize efficiency. Now, isn't that nice? There's no software that compares. Choose Burble. Burble. You know, what's going through my mind as I listen to you is when I've had friends who are what we'll call pastor's kids, it's like, oh, there's a lot of pressure to be the good kid. And then when I think of organizations like the Golden Knights or teams like the Golden Knights or any special forces, if I were to put a brand to it, it's excellence. It's the best of the best. But when it's your father that's affiliated with those things, the son of a father who represents so much excellence, like being an Army Ranger or being the executive officer of the Golden Knights, is that a lot of pressure to perform, to meet the standard of not just the Army, but your dad's expectations? And that just seems like, for me, it would be a lot.
I think in some aspects it was, but it was something that I was just extremely motivated during that age. I do remember when he made it to the Golden Knights, it was the situation was he was a physician's assistant and he was friends with the commander and well steeped within the organization from the outside. You know, he wasn't actually a part of the unit, but he would see, because they didn't have their own medical staff, he would see a lot of the Golden Knights that had different issues and help them out with certain things. Because of that, he was able to form some relationships and had a lot of value. So the commander at the time, Banzai Brantley, who recently died last year, he, you know, saw that value in my father, and they were able to create a slot for him. So he was the medical officer on the team for a time. And then as things happen in the Army, attrition happens and, you know, people leave the unit. He was able to take the place of the executive officer for a time. But I do remember when he originally made the team, I had all my focuses set. That was my number one goal after I graduated high school was to join the Army. And I'd been in the Army for a little bit of time, and I was getting ready to go to tryouts. I remember having these conflicted emotions, because I was happy for my dad on the one hand, but on the other, I was upset because that I thought that I had some ownership of that. So it was a very selfish, you know, thing for me at the time. But I remember going on runs, just, you know, fuming about it, and you know, having to try to process that. I thought it would be more difficult for me to make it through the tryout selection process because he was on the team, and because of the perspective that my peers would have, that I would get some kind of preferential treatment. And he tells the story of having one of the cadre come to his office, Rob Coles. He was going to be the lead cadre. And he was like, "Hey, Rob, I just wanted to, you know, talk to you a little bit. My son's getting ready to go through the selection process." And he was like, I don't want you." He's like, "Hey, don't worry, sir. We got him. You know, no preferential treatment. We're going to take care of him." You know, just like everybody else, you know. Fortunately, you know, it's a testament to the cadre on the team. They didn't give me any preferential treatment. I was going to try to be the gray man going through tryouts. We call it the gray man because you don't want to be the guy at the bottom, you know, the guy that's holding up, you know, everyone else. You don't want to be the guy right at the top that's attracting all the attention to yourself and maybe, you know, getting some resentment from your peers. So you try to be the gray man right in the middle, and that's what I was trying to do. And one of the cadre members on the very first day, as we were pulling out rakes from the bus, and, you know, we would have to do all these activities, we're team building activities, but we'd like pull lawn equipment from the bus to the supply closet in one of the rooms in the barracks. And I remember, you know, hustling and trying to do my part to help the team out. And he was like, we had our names on our shirts, and he was like, "Davidson, Davidson, where do I know that name from? Oh, wait a second. Is your daddy on the team?" I said it in front of all of my peers, and I was like, "Oh no, it's over."
Somehow I would imagine that because your father's on the team, that it would almost be more difficult rather than easier for you, because the perception that you would be getting an easy ride wouldn't be accepted or wish to be perceived. So I almost imagine that it would have been tougher, not easier, so that, you know, no nepotism is getting through with your last name.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I was afraid of, you know, because of that whole situation. But fortunately enough, they treated me just like they treated the rest of the tryouts at the time. And yeah, there's no preferential treatment, and I don't think they treated me any worse either. You know, whenever we had punishment, it was usually group punishment. You know, if something happened on the team, it was because we weren't self-correcting within our team. A lot of it is based on peer evaluations, with the cadre making the final decisions, and they'll make a number of decisions throughout the 8 to 12 week selection process, where they'll bring you in, they'll counsel you. And if at those times, you usually do a peer evaluation. So if you're rated consistently at the bottom of those peer evaluations, then the cadre is just going to let you go. Fortunately, I think, you know, I was able to be a good team player and try to prove my worth so that my peers, you know, recognized that and didn't seem as concerned of the perception of my father being on the team, fortunately.
What is the hardest challenge of going through tryouts for the Golden Knights?
That's a great question. I think there are so many different challenges. It's there's a lot of physical activity. They really try to push you to your limits. You really find out about a person's character when they're completely pushed to their limits and they're exhausted to the point where we can still perform, but you know, you're stressed enough to where your true character comes out. You can't put up a facade anymore. So that's really the one of the goals of the selection process, because you can really teach, if anyone has the potential, which is one of the main criteria they look for, is your potential to learn. But you can teach a lot of people the techniques in skydiving and just the structure, the process of the, you know, the different aerial maneuvers that the team does. But what you can't teach, or, you know, is a person's character. So if they don't have the intangibles, you know, a good work ethic, you'd be a good team player and not a spotlight soldier, as we would call it, someone who shines in front of the cadre members. But, you know, once the cadre is gone, then they kind of revert to, you know, they're a lower self. We really look for those intangibles because the demonstration teams, sometimes they have to spend in excess of 250 days a year traveling on the road. So you want to be traveling with someone that you can get along with, essentially.
Describe what a day looks like in the life of a member of the U.S. Army Golden Knights.
So it varies from team to team. On the competition team, I can speak mostly to that. I was never with the demonstration team. I would strap hang and do some shows from time to time, but I really can't speak to other than what I've seen from the outside as to their daily routine. But as a competitor, we would, when I first made the team, things were a bit different under the team leadership of Scott Rhodes. He would drive us to our limits. We would do, we would arrive at the drop zone very early. At the time, we were training at Rayford, North Carolina, which is now Paraclete XP. And we would do some sort of physical activity as a team. So mostly that consisted of running. We would run a minimum of 2 miles and we would do calisthenics around the field. And we would also, I think once a week, we would do a 4 mile run. You know, so every day it just seemed like we were running and sore. And then on top of that, then we would jump. And at that time, when I first made the 8-way team at the end of 1995, we were still packing for ourselves. We didn't have any packers. So we would make 10 to 12 jumps a day, sometimes more, sometimes 15 or 16, and we would be packing for ourselves too. But to backtrack a little bit to the beginning of the jumping day, we would prep anywhere from 2 to 4 jumps. Usually at the time, we would just do 2. Since we didn't have packers, we would have to, because we only had 2 rigs or 2 parachute systems, we would have to make 2 jumps. And then once we get done with those jumps, we would pack, and then we would go into the team room. And we debrief the video, and depending on what the structure of training was for that day, sometimes we repeat those jumps and other times we just move on. But we would debrief as a team, learn what we needed to fix, and then we'd go up and make those next 2. So those days were very long under his leadership. In those years, I think we had an 1,100 jump year. We had a 1,200 or 1,300 jump year, and we were working extremely hard. And I remember some days just getting home, crashing on the couch, and wondering how I was going to be able to maintain or sustain that, you know, level of energy output for an extended period of time. He was a great leader. You know, that was a great time where I learned a lot about myself at that period of my life. Now things are a little bit different. Fortunately, the team's able to focus more on training, in part because of the packers that we have. They play a huge role in the team's being able to be successful, and we're very appreciative of the role that they play. It allows us to take that energy and focus it even more on jumping. At the time, too, we had the wind tunnel at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and we would spend hours and hours in the wind tunnel there. It's a bit different from the tunnel here at Paraclete XP now and other tunnels around the world where they're fully enclosed, but they have benches outside of the chamber. At the Fort Bragg wind tunnel, they had, once you're in the chamber, you were locked in there, and they had pads on the outside, but you would sit there, you know, whenever it was your turn, we would all jump in, but there were some restrictions to that too. We couldn't fit a full 8-way in there, so we would do some 6-way drills and things like that.
You entered the, or became a member of the team in 95, and you knew you wanted to be on 8-way. There's something about Scott Rhodes, something about him, because I know you'd admired that team and his leadership previous, but why the attraction to 8-way versus 4-way versus demonstration team?
At the time, when I first came to the team, I went straight to the style and accuracy team. And it wasn't because it was the competition, style and accuracy competition team. Usually, once you graduated tryouts, you would go to a demonstration team first. But they started beginning to make some exceptions and taking some of the newly minted tryouts straight to the competition section. And I was fortunate enough to be one of those. And it wasn't because I had any experience or talent. They just saw that maybe I had some potential for style and accuracy. So at that point in time, the eight-way team was full, and I was just of the mindset that I wanted to learn anything and everything, and I was just happy to be there. So they gave me this tremendous opportunity to be on the sound accuracy team. I was able to do that for a couple of years, but I was always, I always dreamed of being on the eight-way team. At the time, the eight-way team were the reigning world champions, and they had some incredible guys, you know, Craig Gerard, Scott Rhodes, Charlie Brown, and others who, you know, who I just really looked up to as heroes ever since, you know, I started finding out about skydiving when I was 14 years old. You know, I would read parachutist magazines from cover to cover, and, you know, and a lot of times the Golden Knights were in there. I would hear stories of these guys from my dad, and I could tell that he looked up to them quite a bit too for their athletic ability and excellence in their field. So they set the bar for where I wanted to be. So I always had that in the back of my mind.
One thing that you mentioned about Packers is, you know, you said it allowed you to focus on competition. I mean, I'm amazed by how many jumps you all were making annually packing for yourselves. That is incredible. And does that have anything to do with your level of fitness? Because you are very physically fit. Have you always had that mentality?
I have, and I think that was instilled by my father from a very early age. He had me working out with him from around the time I was 12 or 14 years old, I think, and he was very physically fit himself, so I looked up to him and saw my mother was very physically fit as well. She was continued to work out a lot after her ballet years. And I remember just how shredded she was. And I remember traveling with my parents whenever we would move from place to place. And I remember in San Antonio in the early 80s, I would go to a World Gym with them, and I would be sitting in the, you know, sometimes they didn't even have a daycare. I can remember, you know, sitting in front of a TV watching MTV while they were, you know, working out in these big, you know, kind of muscle head powerhouse gyms at the time. So I was exposed to it from an early age. And just at some point in time, I made the decision. I was like, I'm going to try to stay as physically fit as possible for as long as possible in my life. I just want it to be a part of my lifestyle. But I really do think it has helped in a lot of ways to be able to withstand, I guess, the rigors of not only competition skydiving, but also things like packing, and helped to prepare me for the onslaught of physical activity, if you will, that was to start happening at the end of 1995.
That's amazing. Correct me if I'm wrong. You joined the team in 95, but were you on the eight-way team in 97 that won the world championships?
I was. I made the Golden Knights at the end of 1993. So yesterday, I was able to go out and see the latest tryouts graduate. It's an incredible experience, but it was on the very same field where 30 years earlier I had landed and done the official knighting ceremony. So that was quite a big deal for me to be able to see them and you know, share in that experience with them. So I was on the silent accuracy team for 2 years, and then at the end of 1995, tried out for the eight-way team, made the eight-way team, and started training in 1996. So yes, I was a part of that team, but I wasn't fully involved in an active slot at the time. I was an alternate for my first 2 years on the eight-way team, but was very fortunate to where guys would have to go to non-commissioned officer professional development schools, and I was able to get in to a slot for a long period of time. And because of that, the way that worked out, different people would have to go to different schools at different times, so I would get lots of experience in all of the different slots, which gave me early on a very comprehensive view of the entire eight-way.
If you're a fan of the 20-Minute Call, I'd like to invite you to be a member of a budding community with me on Patreon. By becoming a patron of the show, you can join me behind the scenes to discuss options for future guests and gain access to some show swag. It's pretty sweet. Details on how to become a patron can be found in the show notes. Okay, back to the show. Matt, I'd like to pivot for a moment here now in your story. In my observation of you, you've always represented excellence and what I consider an aspirational example of what the Army represents. I'd only known of you of your exceptional record, but I didn't know your story, which includes personal adversity. Now, a couple of years ago, I was given the opportunity to interview you on behalf of the International Skydiving Museum and Hall of Fame. In sitting down with you, I expected you to tell me a story, maybe of one of your many world championships. But instead, you chose to tell me the story of your dismissal from the Golden Knights, a story that you described as an event that brought you feelings of dishonor and shame. My admiration for you only increased when you told me this story because you were so vulnerable, as few people willingly share the difficult periods of their life. Usually we get the high notes, not necessarily the low. Furthermore, I was inspired by the story of redemption. Before our listeners who may be unfamiliar with this story, if you're comfortable sharing it, would you?
Sure. If I can think about where to start here, I think it's, so I was on the team for about 7 years when these things started happening. So I'd experienced a lot of early success. I made the team when I was 19 years old and experienced a fair amount of success. I was very disciplined. And I think maybe at that point, I'd begun to take a lot of that for granted and wasn't putting the amount of work in on myself that I should have been to continue growing, and instead got this disease of me, you know, and had a sense of entitlement. And I didn't realize at the time until after things had come to pass, which I'll get to. But so there were several things that started to happen, all of which were either directly or indirectly due to some life choices that I'd made. And one of them was I was going through a divorce at the time and experiencing some financial issues. And on top of that, I started, partying, staying out late, showing up late for training, and things like that, that are just completely unacceptable. But I had just kind of gotten into this downward spiral. It came to a point where, I don't want to curse on your podcast, but the way my father had phrased it, I had left enough piles of crap in enough corners where it just started building up and, leaving a big enough stink to where I was no longer an asset to the team. I was still able to compartmentalize and perform in the air, but, you know, like I said before, the team, we would often talk, use the analogy of the Golden Knights being in a glass house, to where, you know, we're in the public eye, and we need to, you know, maintain high standards of character. And at that point, I wasn't doing that. And I wasn't showing the respect to the rest of my teammates. You know, if one person doesn't show up and you're an integral part of the team, the machine shuts down. And so if I was showing up late, you know, the team would have to wait on me to, you know, to show, until I was able to show up to start, you know, to start training. So it was just, showing a large amount of disrespect to them. And, so anyway, it was, things, you know, finally built up enough to where the sergeant major called me into his office, and I was very unceremoniously asked to leave the team. You know, I was kicked out of the door and asked to find a job elsewhere within the Army. Fortunately enough, things hadn't gotten bad enough in my situation where I got to a level of disciplinary action where I needed to leave the Army. So I was able to go get a job at a rigger unit here on Fort Bragg, and which was essentially like a sweatshop for huge, you know, cargo parachutes. So once I got into that environment, I realized how good I had it on the team. And for a while, you know, I think when you're in that position, you're used to blaming a lot of other people and not accepting responsibility for yourself. So I was reading a book by Pat Riley at the time called The Winner Within, and he talked about that with some of the players on the team that would get to this this period in their careers where they felt very self-entitled, very full of themselves, and would do some of the same behaviors that I was doing. So I think that was kind of a pivotal moment in me being able to self-reflect and really realize too that I needed to take ownership, that I needed to accept responsibility for all the bad things that were happening in my life. It wasn't anybody else that was causing this. It was due to my own choices. So then I made the decision to start digging myself back out of the hole. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I had stopped skydiving for a period of time, about a year, I think, while I was at the 6th Quartermaster Company, just because I was ashamed. I didn't want to go out and, you know, show my face out of the drop zone. I had been a dishonor to my team, and I felt to my father and to my family. Just wasn't a good place and a good time. But fortunately enough, I was approached by a skydiver, and he was a team leader at the time for the 82nd demonstration team, the All-American free fall team for the 82nd Airborne Division. And he came down to, I can remember the day that he walked into the maintenance shed down there, just kind of this dark, dingy, dusty place. You know, he walks in, he was like, Matt Davidson. He just looked like this knight in shining armor and his black flight suit with the, you know, the 82nd patches on. And he was like, come on over here. And he was like, how'd you like to get out of here and come to the 82nd team? I was like, you know what? That sounds really great. And from that point on, I was able to, with his help and guidance and leadership, I was able to take on higher and higher levels of responsibility and start to dig myself back out of that hole. Tommy and Scott Janice, who was a rigger on the 82nd parachute team at the time, they had gone on to the Golden Knights and gone to tryouts. When they did that, I was able to move into the team leader of the 82nd team at the time and take on even higher levels of responsibility. And I think that helped me to build a lot of confidence and helped to show some of the guys on the Golden Knights on the competition team that I wanted to get back into eventually. I set my new goals on getting back onto the team somehow. But I think this was that a big step in showing them that I was able to take on those levels of responsibility. Hope that answered your question.
This happened obviously over 20 years ago. How does it feel to recount that story? I mean, you seem matter of fact about it, but does it still cause you any pain as you recount it?
It does, but on the one hand, it does. On the other, it was, I think, a learning experience that was able to fuel this intense desire in me to get back onto the team and to help rebuild the team. The team had a decade of excellence up until about the point that I left. There were some other things going on in the team, just, you know, different attrition, people leaving the team. And when that happened, Arizona Airspeed was doing 8-way at the time too. So they had kind of taken over and they were winning quite a bit then. So then we went through a decade where we weren't winning that much at all. So it really fueled a desire in me to help do whatever I could do to help get the Golden Knights 8-way team back on top. And I think without that experience, I don't know if I would have been fueled quite the same way to stay in the game as long as I have. So I'd like to think that it served some purpose. Also, a number of very painful years there. And it took me a good 10 years before I was able to shed the reputation that I had earned for myself up to that point. So it was, you know, I had to swallow a lot of pride over that 10-year period. So mixed emotions, I guess.
Knowing that story, I was blown away when you shared it with me. I was surprised that you did and grateful. Why have you been so open about that story? Because most people on the outside of the Golden Knights have no idea.
I think there's people are people, and even at the highest levels of sport, you know, you see the stories happen, you know, quite often where there's a fall from grace somehow or other. And, you know, I think when we get into a place of that amount of public recognition, a lot of things are expected of us, but there's an incredible amount of pressure. Some people handle it great, and others don't. I think that it should be put out there because there are some other people that similar things have happened to, and with a complete zero tolerance policy, it's sometimes some great people have, you know, slipped through the cracks, and I won't put out any names there, but you know, so I think maybe that's one aspect why I've decided to share it, and I don't want to have anything to hide. You know, it was a part of my story, and I accept it as such, and I've tried to learn lessons from it. And maybe if others get into that situation, they can have some hope of digging themselves out of the hole as well.
It's funny, when you first told me that story and then after the fact I reflected on it, I try to have empathy. The words that you had mentioned was, you know, shame. And just as we started, you know, being the son of your dad with so much accomplishment and feeling the feelings of disappointment that you felt that he would be feeling. And then almost like this, I mean, it's almost like a movie where like you're banished to the glory of wearing the regalia of the Golden Knights, which represents so much to repairing cargo parachutes. You know, what I can only imagine is sort of this dark, hot, you know, facility. What did you hold on to in those dark moments? Because it must have felt like that there wasn't a lot of hope to ever return.
It did feel like that. It did. There's some very dark days there. It felt like there wasn't much hope. I didn't know what direction my life was going to take. I had lost the huge sense of purpose that had been fueling me up to that point in my life. And I felt very directionless at that point in time. And I think it was, I kind of stayed in that rut until I was able to start accepting responsibility for my actions. And once I did, that was a huge pivotal moment for me. And it took, things didn't start happening instantly by any stretch of the imagination. It took a lot of hard work to get out of that. But I think that, those were the emotions that I was going through at the time.
What was the period of time between being dismissed from the team and then your reentry into the team?
There were 2 years. So there was 1 year where I didn't skydive at all. And I stayed in the 600 quartermaster company. And I don't want to take anything away from that company. I think at that point in time, that facility is closed now. So I'm not sure I think they've got, updated facilities, and it's not as much of a sweatshop type of feel as it was then. It was just a different time, but it's just a contrast to what the Golden Knights were. The mission of the 600 Quartermaster Company at the time and maintaining these huge parachutes has, you know, played a huge role in the success of airborne operations at Fort Bragg for, you know, delivering cargo. But it was just a contrast from the Golden Knights for me. And if you could remind me what the original question was, I lost my train of thought.
Sure. Just what were you holding on to? What gave you a little bit of hope to keep pushing forward through that dark time?
I think it was when Tommy Sullivan came into the building and asked me if I wanted to be a part of the 82nd free fall team. That really gave me the hope. I was like, okay, maybe this is an opportunity that I can start to help to dig myself out of the hole that I'd created.
That adversity has propelled you, gave you a fire. And of course, you know, your career includes 7 world championships. Tom Brady has his favorite Super Bowl moment. Can you share a moment in your career or competition career that you're particularly proud of?
It was in 2012 at Skydive Dubai. We had come off, I think, 15 years, a 15-year span since the Golden Knight 8-way team had won a world-level championship. We'd won the World Cup in Saarlouis, Germany the year before, and that was huge as well. But I think because the World Championships is just, feels a little more elevated there, and that was our main goal, was to win the World Championships. It was on an incredible stage, an incredible place, you know. Dubai, we were able to jump over the Palm Islands, you know, so it was just a bunch of, you know, the environment was magic, and it was just magic the way that the meet ended. And it was a time that I was able, I remember we were all in one of the hotel rooms there that was close to Jumeirah Beach, and in one of these high rise buildings, great view of the beach and the Palm Island. And I remember we were all talking in there, and everyone was kind of going around and saying what the experience meant to them. And for me, I remember saying in so many words, it was the culmination of, you know, years of trying to get back onto the team and help do whatever I could to help get the team back on top. So I felt like, you know, I was able to play a part in that, and it was just a period of redemption for me at that point. So I think that was it for me.
Would you say that a moment also, it's a period of redemption. Is it also a period where you allow yourself to forgive yourself, or was that even needed?
Maybe. I think there probably was an element of that. I don't know if I thought about that specifically, but I still felt like there was lots and lots of work to be done. Whenever you win a competition like that, it's great. I was just having a podcast conversation yesterday with XPSN, and in it, Jake Carlton, you know, mentioned something which, you know, echoed my sentiments about it. And it was that, you know, when you're standing up there on the podium, it's a great experience, but it's, you know, you start to look at what's next. It's being on the podium in and of itself. It can be a little hollow feeling, because right after it's over, you've completed this goal. Unless you've got another goal, it can feel a little bit empty. And he said that it's more about the journey. And, you know, I said the prize is in the process, which it really is. It's the journey of everything leading up to it. It's the hard times, the hard training, the good times, you know, maybe a little bit of conflict that's helped you to reach the next level. Yeah, I just think that I had in my mind, and in the rest of my teammates' mind too, we knew that, you know, we had other goals to do to try to keep the team winning in a sustained fashion. So I think our goal at that point was we wanted to help the team achieve another decade of excellence.
I can't even imagine the joy that you felt, but also, as you just said, you know, the challenge, it's not over. There's still more work to be done. If you could recognize someone that has been an instrumental figure in either your personal or professional development, who would that person be?
Oh, there have been so many. I think first and foremost, my wife, Jen. She's been extremely great. I think she's, you know, made me a better person being with her. But I've had so many positive influences and role models in my life, from Scott Rhodes to Craig Gerard, my father, you know, being one of the first and foremost. My mother, you know, she's always been great and very encouraging of me and whatever my desires are. And whenever I've been in the low moments, she's always known exactly just the right thing to say to maybe guide me in a new direction and encourage me to do that. But, you know, I've been extremely fortunate. You know, I feel blessed to have so many people that have had such a positive influence in my life. It's really difficult to choose just one.
When I interviewed Craig Gerard, he told me a story of meeting George and Barbara Bush and shared how wonderful they were. As a former Golden Knight, I imagine you've met some pretty famous people in your journey. Have you met someone famous or influential that really impressed you?
I've met several that have. I remember meeting George Clooney when we were training at Skydive Arizona. We were staying at the same hotel he was in Casa Grande. I think they were filming Three Kings at the time. And our videographer at the time, Ken Brown, his brother was a cinematographer. And I believe he and George Clooney were friends, so they would go on fishing trips. But I remember just, you know, having a couple drinks with him at the bar at the hotel, and just remembering how friendly and approachable he was. I remember a woman came up and asked him for his autograph, and he drew a little picture, you know, took the time, drew a little picture, and he was just as friendly as could be. He's the one that comes to mind first. I was able to meet George Bush as well, and he was always very supportive of the team. With his support, the Golden Knights were able to make their relatively new headquarters facility. Before that, they were in these old World War II barracks that were just, you know, deteriorating over time. And he was very instrumental in helping the Golden Knights to get this incredible new facility, which they're still in today. Over the years, I helped to construct some letters to write to him. I remember when he and Barbara were in the hospital, and he would reply, and you could tell it wasn't, you know, just written by an aide or something. It was it came from him. That was very meaningful. But there have been several over the years. One of the one thing that stands out is when I was fortunate enough to be able to be on the Transformers 2 Revenge of the Fallen set. So we were able to jump in there and Halo High Altitude Low, opening the tactical military insertion part of free fall. And we were asked for some Golden Knights who were HALO qualified. Unfortunately, I was at the time, so I was able to be part of that. And then once we got the jump into the set, we got it done in one take, and we were scheduled to be there for a week. So Michael Bay asked us, he was like, "Hey, you guys want to hang out and, you know, be extras on the set?" You're like, "Yeah, that'd be great." So we were able to do that. So I was able to meet the cast of Transformers 2 at the time. And one person who really stands out and who I still have a relationship with today is Matthew Marsden. He was also in Black Hawk Down. He was the guy that was going to cut his cast off and wanted to get back into the fight. And he's been in a number of other movies as well, but he's always been very supportive of the military community. And, you know, I stay in contact with him, you know, from time to time. He still supports the military a lot. And he's just one of those people who's very down to earth. He's very family oriented and, you know, just salt of the earth kind of guy.
Wow. Those are some cool stories for sure. This podcast is sponsored by Beyond Marketing, the digital marketing agency for the skydiving industry. Now, I'm not a fan of lots of ads during a podcast. I mean, who likes ads? So I'll stop talking about how marvelously wonderful Beyond Marketing is. But if you're curious about what the amazing people of Beyond Marketing do to help drop zones and manufacturers thrive, then you should check out their website at dropzone.marketing. That's dropzone.marketing. Before I pivot to the next question, I have to ask, you're also a DJ in this new civilian life of yours, and I live just south of Charlotte, and I've seen you performing in some clubs here in Charlotte as the feature DJ. Tell me about that. How did you get into DJing? How are you getting gigs at clubs in Charlotte? Tell me about that.
So I got into DJing, I think it was in the year 2000. I just had an interest. I loved the music, and I listened to the music all the time. I thought it created a great backdrop in my mind for the pace of skydiving, and it just fit it very well. The BPM or beats per minute are usually, you know, around one, anywhere from, you know, 122 to 130. So, you know, it kind of, you know, is just provides a great backdrop for skydiving and visualizing as far as that goes. And I remember seeing the Blade movie, and I remember there's a DJ scene there, and I was just like, wow, that's really cool. So and then I'd gone down to Florida and was at a club called the Amphitheater, where they had a big rotating dance floor. They had a huge stage that had speakers that went up to the bottom of the stage. It was probably 10 or 15 feet high, and they had just had dancers, you know, doing breakbeat that had, you know, all kinds of glowing costumes, that kind of stuff. And they had a like a foam party at the end of it. And I just remember, you know, listening to the DJ there, and that had a big influence on me. So I got some vinyl turntables and a mixer and started playing around with it. You know, just kept it primarily as a hobby. And then I think it was about 10 years ago, I started actively seeking out, you know, ways that I could perform myself. So started out at PK's. I think it was Halloween in 2013. And then, you know, just through social media networks, I was able to make some connections and talk to an artist, Ariel Dominguez, who goes by the DJ name of Dami, and she's very influential in the Charlotte house music scene. And I was able to approach her, and she gave me a couple of opportunities to play at some of her events up there, which I was, you know, very grateful for. She's a great person, and you can tell she cares a lot about the dance music community up there. And it's kind of like skydiving in that it's a subculture all its own. And I think you get the same endorphin rush of, you know, as you would do on a jump or a competition jump, you know, where I get the same round one jitters as I do for, you know, skydiving, as I do when I'm getting ready to go up and play in front of a crowd. It's just, it's just an incredible experience when you're able to tap in and strike a chord, no pun intended, but, you know, when you're able to really make a connection with the audience, you know, that's just a feeling like no other. It's just like an incredible round 10 jump where you know that you've just crushed the performance, you know you've won. It's that same kind of elated experience. So that's part of the, you know, the fun about it. And I also really enjoy the artistic aspect of it, because when you're mixing music, there's so many different types of possibilities. You can take loops of certain tracks and create your, you know, a new track, or, you know, when you're doing a live performance, you pick segments of songs and you can use segments for buildups. And it's just, there's a lot of art in it that allows me an escape, I guess.
Is this your way of sort of flexing the creative muscle that you have? Because, you know, back at the beginning of our interview, you were, I don't want to call you a theater kid, but you were involved in the theater. And is this the creative side of you? And are there other creative endeavors that you are doing that also flexes those muscles? And by the way, I'm just glad to know that you even have first round jitters with your resume. It makes me happy to know that.
Always do. Yeah. I think it probably does. I think you're accurate in that. It is a way for me to express myself artistically through that medium. I also like to draw. I've drawn all my life, and I drew the coloring book, a couple different coloring books for the Golden Knights that they published and would take out to on the demonstration circuit, pass out to the kids. I need to start drawing a bit more, you know, since we're talking about it. But also started playing guitar a couple of years ago. I remember my dad playing guitar quite a bit, you know, back at when I was a kid back at Fort Benning. I think those are some of my fondest memories, being able to hang out with him, you know, when he was just messing around with the guitar. I remember the record collection that he had that was very influential on me. I can remember, you know, it was almost a romantic thing of watching the record spin and, you know, listening to anything from the Eagles to Led Zeppelin. My grandfather used to play the organ for his church. And I can remember just watching him for hours and watching how deeply involved and almost one he became with the organ. I can remember, you know, sometimes when he wasn't there, if he was out mowing lawn or something in their farmhouse in New Hampshire, I can remember, you know, starting the organ up, and it had different presets in the organ itself. So they would play, you know, like the cha-cha or merengue, different, you know, kind of dance beats to that. And I think maybe that was kind of maybe something in the back of my mind that maybe led me to DJing. But I think throughout my life, I've always had an artistic thread there and the desire to take that and to, you know, perform in front of people. But I think podcasting is an artistic venture too, as you're well aware.
Matt, this is going to sound like a strange question, but do you think that because of your fitness and your record that you could be stereotyped? Like, there is so much depth to your life and your interests that people could overlook or make assumptions about you because you kind of look like a G.I. Joe. I mean, I don't mean to sound to give you too much puffery, but you are the most physically fit or shredded dude that I think I've ever seen.
I appreciate that.
You know what I mean? But do you feel like that there are stereotypes or people that may overlook, like, there is a lot to Matt Davidson?
Maybe at one time. I don't know if I'm overly concerned with, you know, people having that perception. I have heard it commented by people several times that, oh, wow, I didn't know you had all these interests or talents. And, you know, they seem very surprised by it.
So, I mean, you don't sound retired, even though you are retired from the Army. You've got a lot of creative pursuits. Is there anything that you're noodling on right now that you're excited about or you haven't started that you're thinking about?
I think becoming getting my private pilot's license. My father flies quite a bit. He has a Cessna 182 that he actually bought from Gene Paul Thacker before he died out at Rayford. And he still comes back once a year to do his annual maintenance there. He does all or most of the maintenance himself and then gets it checked off by an A&P. But I think eventually he's talked more and more about it as far as leaving the plane to me, you know, when it's time. And, you know, with Jen being a pilot as well, I think I would like to be part of that. So earlier on in the year, this year, you know, I did a couple of hours of flying time with him and, you know, landed the plane a few times. And, you know, he's teaching me, you know, some different maneuvers. So I'd really like to do that. the podcasting, I've just picked back up again after a lengthy break, and I'm really, really excited about that. Got some new equipment, and I'm starting to get more and more guests on and lined up, and that really, really drives me, I think, more than anything else. And as you can attest, you know, there's just something magical about having conversations and learning, you know, more things about people. And after every conversation I've gotten up from, it's always been such an incredible experience. And you bonded more with the people that you talk to. They seem excited. You're excited. I think there's an endorphin rush from that too. But you just have this connection that you don't normally have. And I think passing conversation, because you've got these long form conversations and you're able to bond with someone over that amount of time.
Yeah. I will say to be able to speak with you and other people that I admire in the sport to get a little deeper, and allowing the audience to learn beyond the jumpsuit. It's really nice to hear the story, you know, as is the case with say Craig or Dan or yourself, what drove you to those victories. I'm impressed by the outcome, but I'm more fascinated by the journey. It's so interesting to learn.
Oh, thank you.
Final question, Matt. I ask this to most of my guests. I'm always intrigued by crossroads moments. You know, there's a moment that may occur in our lives that seem almost mundane when presented with having to make a choice or saying yes to something, or maybe meeting someone that we don't know is going to have huge influence on our life. And had we not met that person or said yes to that almost mundane opportunity or whatever, you don't have the life or the story or the victories that you have. Is there a crossroads moment that comes to mind for you that's been instrumental in the very fact that we're talking here today?
I think that moment was when Tommy Sullivan came into 600 Quartermaster Company and asked if I wanted to be part of the 82nd team. I think that was really, that was a huge crossroads. I think another huge crossroads was meeting my wife, Jen. I think I was in a period of life at the time where I'd, you know, had a number of failed relationships. I think in the beginning of our relationship, I wasn't as committed as I should have been, or maybe didn't have the same level of commitment she did, until she sat me down one day and talked to me and, you know, basically said that, you know, if it continued along that path, that wasn't going to work for her. Essentially, she was, you know, putting up some boundaries, and the way she said it, it was just, you know, it made me realize how wonderful of a person she was. And I already knew, but I think I wasn't giving her enough credit in my mind because of my previous experiences. I think maybe I was painting or overlaying my experiences on her, which wasn't fair to her at the time. And through my behaviors, I think it was just things like, you know, I wasn't prioritizing, you know, spending enough time with her, that kind of thing. But she let me know in no uncertain terms that that was unacceptable. And then there was another pivotal moment where shortly after we had been together from my previous relationship, Rachel, who's a girlfriend at the time, I've learned that she was pregnant. When I brought that up to Jen, you know, I expected her to, you know, not want to continue our relationship anymore. And when I let her know, the first thing she said was, she nodded her head and she was like, okay, we can make this work. And I was completely shocked. And it was in those couple moments that I already knew she was a special and wonderful person, but it was in those moments that, you know, that just solidified that for me. So I think those are a couple of the biggest crossroads.
Those are big crossroads for sure. Have you ever thought about where you might be if you weren't presented the opportunity to jump with the 82nd?
Yeah, I think I have thought about that, but it's impossible to really think where life would have gone, but it definitely, it would have taken on a different hue for sure.
And I just have to comment on your wife, Jen. I've met her and had the privilege of interviewing her a couple of years ago, not for this podcast, but for a different project with the museum and Hall of Fame. And she's a powerhouse.
She is.
And very grounded, very grounded. It doesn't seem like she lets the hype around her accomplishments, you know, slow her down in any negative way. She's already moved on, you know, to the next goal, I guess, you know, in helicopters, which I'm just watching with, you know, great interest. A wonderful human being.
She is. Yeah. She is a powerhouse, and she accepts, you know, nothing short of excellence from herself. And I think that should be an inspiration to everyone. You know, she's just, she's an inspiration to me for sure. Whenever I go down there, you know, help her read some of her cue cards to study for her exams. And she's disappointed in herself if she gets anything less than 100%. You know, she, just like anyone else, she struggles with, you know, learning new tasks. And so with, you know, flying helicopters in the beginning, I can remember the first platform they were flying was the Lakota helicopter. And I can remember her having a little trouble in the beginning. But, you know, I tried to, you know, help her by saying, you know, I'm sure you are, but once you get used to it, you know, you're going to thrive in the environment. And she did with that. And I think she's in the beginning stage of the Black Hawk now. So she's having some good days and bad days, she says, but I have no doubt that, you know, by the time it's all over, she's going to be one of the best for sure.
Matt, I have to comment. I really wanted to keep this to an hour. I'm such a bad podcast host, but I'm just so engaged and enjoying our conversation.
I've got no other commitments. That's fine.
Thank you for that. And I'll wrap us here in a moment. One thing that that strikes me about you is your incredible level of self-awareness. You speak about past challenges or adversity, very matter-of-factly, own your stuff, and then share, this is what I learned and this is what I did with it. That teaches me too, because sometimes when we are going through periods of adversity, maybe we don't learn from it, or maybe we never get beyond it. I just feel that your story is inspiring for those that maybe who are listening right now, who may be going through whatever challenge and feel like that there isn't a light at the end of the tunnel. But if they keep pushing, that maybe someone is paying attention, as someone was paying attention to you when they came in and said, you know, hey, do you want to try out for the 82nd? Thank you for your vulnerability and your willingness to share not just the highs, but the lows, because if all we ever know about the highs, then we don't know the realities of what you got to go through to get there. And I find it super inspiring. And I'm so glad also that The Champion's Journey is back, your podcast, because I, as you know, that actually inspired me to get moving on my own.
Oh, wow.
Because I really enjoyed it so much and had been in my craw for a while that I needed to do this. And then I was like, wow, I just so enjoyed what you were doing, and even approached you about advertising on your podcast too. And we can still talk about that, but thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for your story. Thank you for inspiring so many of us.
Oh, thank you so much for your kind words. That means an incredible amount to me. And yeah, I just can't thank you enough for having me on and for having this incredible conversation.
The pleasure is mine. Thanks, Matt.
Sure. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to the 20 Minute Call podcast. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode, which is released every Monday. If you want to contact the team, our email address is podcast@beyondmarketing.xyz. This episode was edited and engineered by Garnet Znydrick of the YouTube channel Blue Skies Fun Days. Thanks for listening, and join us next week for our next episode.